Welcome to the New Fat and Droids podcast. You reckon 218?
218, perhaps.
You're happy?
Yeah.
We have a guest this week.
We do. I find him.
Unbelievably, and they actually showed up, which was touch and go, wasn't it, at some point?
Well, I'd sent him an email with the link, and he didn't get it, so I had to quickly email him whilst we were... Actually, we'd started recording, and he hadn't turned up.
Did we?
Well, I'd hit start.
Ah. Well, hopefully...
Anyway, he did turn
hopefully
up.
They've cut that out.
Maybe you should check that.
Add that. It was a good guess. Well, it's a good guess coming up. How did you find them?
How did I find him? We ran with him initially in 2019.
That's right.
In Jordan. Whenever he was working or just started working for Ultra X. And I've been following his journey over the last few years.
Yeah.
I thought he'd be quite a good person to talk to. And yeah, sure enough,
it was.
He was.
It was.
Very good.
Hoka are now open in Yas Mall,
they
Abu Dhabi.
Are a store, bricks and mortar store, not just online.
Blue signs, colors, what are they called? Mannequins,
yeah,
with shoes on.
Oh, we haven't been yet, unfortunately. We will go.
We welcome them to open in Dubai.
Yeah, that'd be nice. There is, I think, is there plans? Oh, there must be.
I'm
can
sure.
Open in Abu Dhabi and
for
not
sure.
Dubai.
For sure.
That'd be very nice.
Milan Marathon.
Milan Marathon.
Coming up.
2 weeks away. Big cohort just, traveling
just
to Milan.
Under, just under. And we've got a few going to Paris Marathon
which
as well.
Is next weekend as well. Same day.
I think so, yeah.
Same day.
Same day. Then we... Well, you're not coming, are you? I thought you were, and I realise you're not. But Greece, Exterra Greece.
No, I'll be moving house. Down.
You're moving.
I'm moving house, so that's okay.
Above a five guys.
It's going to go one of two ways. In 6 months' time, I might be 40 kilos heavier.
Yes.
Or I'll have joined the boxing gym next door and I will be cauliflower-eared, broken-nosed.
Rob Tyson.
Rob Tyson.
And then the end of season is close, which means ITD.
Yeah. It's actually not... What are we, on recording day, we are 8 weeks away because we always do it the week before the athletes.
Projectile vomit night.
So 9 weeks away until the clients and our athletes run into the darkness, which is 50K bike, 50K run, 50K bike. We've just come in from the coffee shop where people are already hustling each other on what they should be doing on the night.
Adriana
it's quite
wants
exciting.
To swim.
Adriana's trying to figure out if she wants to do a 100K run or if she wants to ride and run. What excites you?
Who
because
knows?
Really, there are no rules on the night, are there?
Well, there is one main rule, which is...
If you want to get on the board.
Yeah. If you want to get on the board, 50 ride, 50 run, 50 ride before the sun comes up.
Yes. If you miss the sunrise, you don't get on the board.
No.
Because you have failed.
You have to take the rabbit home from Zad's. That's the rule.
And we all go home.
Yes.
This is the key.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we could stay. The problem is, the reason we had to put the cap on it is because people would keep going until they finished. And we might be there 3 days.
Yeah, which we don't want to be. So yeah, you could run 50K. You could ride 50, run 25, ride 50. There's many options available. But if you want your name on the board, you ride 50, you run 50, you ride 50, and you do it before the sun comes up.
I think it's one of my favorite nights of the year.
For sure. For
something you, that happens that's super exciting every year. Highlights.
Your excitement barometer peaks at the end of May every year.
Was it last year? So who was driving Rickson's car and got it stuck at his first checkpoint? I think two and a half.
Someone.
I don't know who it was. Anyway.
Yeah.
Little things each week.
Was it? I think it was Rickson. He was supporting someone else.
Oh, and he got his own car stuck.
Something like that.
Speaking of
being up for 3 days, on the weekend we went to Jace to support Nick Glover, who was riding a triple Everest, which is a lot.
A triple. So for those that are unaware of what a triple Everest might be, although it seems very simplistic when you say it is a ride or run where you accumulate the elevation gain of Everest.
Three times.
So we're looking at about 25,000 meters.
27,600 and something.
27,600. It's a lot.
Yeah, just shy of 1,000 kilometers on Jace. That's the thing about Everesting is you can find a very short, punchy climb and do a lot of reps. But here, sort of, I don't know what her feet would take. Should look into it. But Jace, you basically end up riding per Everest about 320 to 330 kilometers because it's a 20-something K climb to hit the 1,000 meters.
And it's all fairly gradual up Jace as well, isn't it? It doesn't kick up or flatten off really.
And I didn't know this, but Nick was saying when we were riding up with him, the rule is that you have to start and finish at the same places. So, for example, for him, he was starting from the Bear Grylls camp and the top of the climb where he was turning was the what we call the top. And to be an official Everest, you have to continue on that route. So you couldn't come back down halfway and then choose a steep point to go up and down on. You have to, if you choose, whatever you choose to start and wherever you choose to turn, you have to keep that as your starting turn.
Your first rep, if you like, has to be the same rep continually.
Yeah, which to me made sense. And that's when I've done Everest in the past, that's what I've done. But some people I know do that to start with and then they go and find a steeper part and do a couple reps to mix it up. And then they might go back and do a longer one. But I didn't realize this. That's apparently not, you don't get on the Everest website for that.
Yeah. Good to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Nick did it. He did it. He started at 9 p.m. on Thursday and he finished it, I think it said 12:45 on Monday morning.
Wow.
Nonstop.
12:45. Yeah. Wow. Nonstop. And Monday we went morning. On Saturday and you rode with him. So that, how far through was he then?
He was halfway.
Halfway.
He was halfway through.
What was the spirit like then?
He was pretty good, huh? Was yeah, it? Yeah. And we talked absolute nonsense for the entire rep. And he's like, this is the best company I've had for the whole thing. Because he probably didn't have a clue who we were talking about, what we were talking about. But it was just me, Skinny, Marcus, and AB. And we just sort of got around him and sheltered him. And he rode up and he was good. It was good. I think at those kind of challenges, once you get to halfway and you can start framing it in your mind of it's almost all downhill from here, you know, he'd already been going for 2.5 days. Days.
And what was the strategy, sleep wise and rep wise? Did he
I'm
have
not
a strategy?
Sure. We'll have to get him on.
Skinny had a spreadsheet he sent out. I wonder, did he stick to it? Yeah.
No, he didn't. He was well behind.
Was he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because they started late. But yeah, we'll have to get him on the show. And talk to us about it once he's recovered, once he's got feeling back in his extremities and key places.
How long, when you did one, how long did it take you to, well, firstly, how long did it take you and how long did it take you to recover? I remember being there, but I can't remember finer details.
The first one I did was, ride time was like 14 and like high 14 hours.
That was in the UK, was it?
I was here on Jace.
Have you done one in the UK that was on a steeper hill?
No.
Maybe you were just talking
both
about it.
Both on Jace.
Both on Jace. Okay, so 14 hours.
Like 14 hours, 50 or something like that. Total time was like 20 something hours. That was like a random Wednesday morning. It was just me and Marcus. And I had never been on Jace. So it was the first time I ever rode Jace. And I did it as prep for Ironman South Africa. Well, that's what I told myself. I'm not sure why I truly did it. So it was like all brand new to me. It was the first time I'd ever ridden Jace and then continued to ride it for 8 more times. And then if you remember 2020, we were in the old gym and they announced they were shutting all gyms down. And so we said, all right, let's go Everest on. So that was a Monday. And then we decided on the Wednesday we'd go and Everest. Captain Nick Mingay also decided to come along. And do you remember we rode side by side the whole day until the last rep?
Last rep.
And then at halfway I went, see you later.
Absolutely destroyed him. Took his soul
apart.
Took
his soul. That one was quicker. That was like low 14 hours for it, yeah. But again, the whole time, that's ride time. The whole time was still around 20 hours.
Yeah.
You just lose time and... You feeding, refilling your pockets, your bottles.
If 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there.
Yeah.
Adds up really quick.
Yeah.
Remember, actually, this is coming back to Into the Darkness. When people talk about, you know, they want to run a 5 hour 50K loop. Like, okay, well, you need to really be running that at 5:30 per K. If you try and hold 6 minutes a K, then it's not going to happen, because you do, if you stop every 5K for 60 seconds,
yeah, you know,
doing that 10 times in the course of the block.
Yeah, it's gone.
It's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotta, I think, really smart with your steps.
Everything can sound hard, but it's actually quite achievable. You just have to be good at sitting on your bike for a long time and pushing the pedals. But a triple is mad. Absolutely mad.
I wonder what the optimal gradient is where...
It's been figured out. There's an Irish, I think he's Irish, he's got the world record for it. It's like low, I want to say 6 or 7 hours. And it's basically, you do like, I can't remember how many reps, but it's in, I think in the hundreds, but it's on a really steep, like 100 meter climb at like 20% or something like that. And they cut like the handlebars shorter, and like the bikes are like uber lightweight. It's a proper thing, like real proper thing.
It takes you a long time to get up that climb, but then really quick to get back down.
No, it's 100 meters of like 10%, so there's nothing. You just basically sprint up it. Each effort's like 2-3 minutes, then you come back down and you just repeat like that. You want maximum elevation gain in minimal time. Yeah, but Jace is not like that.
Max effort up Jace to still take you an hour.
Yeah, each rep was taking me like an hour 20, hour 30.
Oh,
good times.
Right,
actually, today's guest has done Everest. I saw on his website.
He has. Yeah. Yes. Shall, well, today, a little bit of, well, we've kind of started off on who today's guest is. We met him in 2019 in the Jordanian desert. His name is Taylor Chris Taylor. He is a coach, athlete, ultra runner, and event organizer for people that want to do FKTs, world record challenges, or they just have a cool idea and they want to execute it. He will help you plan it, train it, run it, come along and do it with you.
Yeah, that's not the interesting part of this.
No, so. He also is a very interesting backstory, which I guess you could say maybe led him to this journey.
We get into it. You didn't ask me anything about Ironman rules, by the way, but maybe that's for next week.
Oh, no, go on then. What are your thoughts, before we get into the interview, on the new Ironman rules that I mentioned in last week's show?
Can you remember them?
I do. You're not allowed to tape your bike to make it more aerodynamic. Thoughts?
Good. Correct. Good.
You're allowed to tape nutrition to your bike still.
Yeah. That always makes me laugh. Just gels taped to the top tube on your aerodynamic $10,000 bike.
Second rule, you're not allowed to stick bottles or anything else down your bib shorts, I guess.
Tri-suit.
Yeah.
Front. Smart.
Or back.
Smart. Because the pros do it because they found it's more aerodynamic. And that's great. And the top age groupers can do it. Great. But everybody always wants to follow those people on. And what you don't want is someone to put a camelback down their top, which slips out the bottom, goes into their drive chain, gets stuck. They go over the handlebars and cause carnage in everyone behind them. So I agree. Like, relax. It's going to save you, whatever, 2 seconds over, I don't know, 10 kilometers. Like, perfect. It's okay.
Third one, the rule on littering, accidental and or otherwise.
Yeah, I thought that was always a rule, to be honest. I think they've changed the time penalties around it.
Yeah.
But it's not hard, right?
I think it's
throw automatic. Your litter in a designated litter zone.
I think it's disqualification, though.
Okay, yeah.
As opposed to a time penalty.
It's pretty obvious when you're in a litter designated zone. Throw it. Don't when you're not.
Makes sense. That's why all these bib shorts have pockets.
Tri-suits.
Fucking hell. And the last one was... unzipping your tri-suit. It has to be, you can unzip it, but it has to still be attached to the bottom. No flappy bits.
Yeah.
Make a difference, does it not?
I mean.
Really? Is that just.
No, I don't think so. I don't know why they've added that rule in, but every rule is always invented because someone has cocked something up in some other way. So obviously someone managed to cock up whatever that was and they've decided to put a rule in saying it. Yeah.
There you go.
It's odd.
Maybe we'll find out why that rule. The other rules make sense. That one doesn't really make sense to me. But
yeah. But as always, it's always like, it's just about making it a level playing field for everybody. And yeah, who cares? If as long as everyone's not allowed to put a bottle down their top, then what's the problem? Yeah. You know?
I think they need to fix the drafting rule first and foremost.
Absolutely, mate. Fix the drafting rule.
Worry about the rest after.
If you're not, if your watts per kilo aren't above 4, then stop buying disc wheels. If your ground contact time isn't below 2.5 milliseconds, stop wearing carbons. Yeah, I have a few of my own rules in there.
The Tom Walker Triathlon Series would be brilliant. Excellent. Right, let's crack into this interview this week with Taylor, Chris Taylor.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
So we're just reminiscing of when we first met back in October, November of 2019 in Ultra X Jordan. And I believe back then you were a race director, and it was your first race, but you were directing the race at the same time. Is that right?
Yeah, not quite. Very poor race directing to kind of run your own race. No, I just started working for Ultra X. Kind of operations manager type thing. But I'd actually signed up to the race 6 months before I started working with him. So when I started working, I said, not that I was pacing conditions, but I said, I'll definitely want to start, but can I still run the race? And they're like, yeah, of course you can. So no, that was not me in any shape or capacity as in work mode. That was very much me having a good run. Yeah. And we shared a few miles on day one, didn't we?
We did. And then I think you dropped me on day one, didn't you?
No, other way around. Why would you set me up for that? You know for a fact you dropped me. What a sad stuff.
Just stroking my ego here.
To give the background, you went wrong in a front pack of like 4 or 5 people, and you took a wrong direction, and then so I ended up catching you, and we shared a few miles, talked about your background, I think, talked about your army brat, I think, I remember.
That's right.
I don't know where I pulled that from. And then at the end, you went, right, I'm feeling pretty good, see you later. And that was pretty much the last time I saw you that week. No, we shared a few more.
Yeah. So you tell us a bit about you then. Who is Taylor Chris Taylor? What's your background? Where do you come from? What do you do?
Thanks for highlighting Taylor Chris Taylor first, because we were just talking before we hit record. My name is obviously Chris Taylor, but everyone calls me Taylor, and I've tried to engineer people towards that route by using my Instagram handle, which Rob has just enunciated clearly. Taylor Chris Taylor. And Taylor made. So yeah, but people don't know me, I go by Taylor. I'm a running coach and event organizer. As we'll get into, I've kind of switched from organizing commercial events to doing like personal bespoke challenges, but still doing a bit of both, and coaching as well. So my work life is, I guess, 50% coaching, depending on the time of year, 50% event organizing. And then, yeah, from a personal perspective, I'm very much still as much as I can amongst the busy lifestyle. I'm sure you guys can both appreciate and empathize with that. Try and do my own adventures and challenges when I can. Normally, my vibe is still focused towards the kind of ultra distance mountain races, but I still do some road running every now and again. I live in Sheffield near the Peak District in the UK, so it's relatively hilly, but compared to, you know, the kind of Alps style mountain races that I think we all like to do, it's still nowhere near the same. It's a good mixture of terrains here, but not the altitude. And that's me, really. Yeah, I just kind of train as much as I can whilst helping other people train as much as they can and organize some cool events and rinse and repeat. Good life.
How did you first get into ultra running and ultra distance running? What was the pull for you to step towards that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I feel like this is a classic intro into it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I hated running when I was a kid. Is that a common thing?
Yeah, I would hide behind the tree in the playground when we were doing cross country until the second lap, and then try and jump onto the back of the group.
I wasn't quite that committed to to avoiding it, but yeah. Yeah, similar vibe. It was, I don't know, it was always just, I feel like there was a few, there's definitely a few cross country like stars, wasn't there, when we were kids? Like, a few, but I feel like it was like two or three per school that actually liked running. That's my kind of appreciation of it.
The guys that were good at it.
But hardly anyone else. Anyway, so that was my kind of relationship with it through most of my teens, to be honest. I played football when I was younger. And again, like the running side was always the, either the punishment for not doing, you know, for being late or something, you do, you know, what were the drills where you go up and down, the shuttle runs, that sort of thing. Always a bleep test at school, which again felt like a punishment. And yeah, never really got any enjoyment from it. And that kind of probably continued into, so I did a lot of rowing at university. And again, it complemented training. That was when I first really started focusing on performance more than anything else. So I saw running as a useful contributor to, you know, my kind of overall endurance fitness, but still wouldn't draw much actual satisfaction from the process itself. It was more doing this will make me better at X. And then, you know, sport's always been my life. I've studied sport and exercise science at university, and exercise physiology was my kind of main passion in that broad field. And I'm not really interested in running. You know, I'm already at my early 20s at this stage. Post-university, I actually joined the Royal Marines, which is probably why we got onto the topic of talking about that in Jordan, I imagine, in your kind of army background. It was only, again, during that, hated it, very much a punishment. You spend your life being goosed, and running is the easiest way to kind of thrash someone. So very much not, there's no enjoyable running in that journey. But by consequence of literally, I'm being forced to run quite a lot every single day, I came out of that experience relatively fit. And it was only then, and I'm in my mid to late-ish 20s at this point, where I was like, I'm probably quite fit, never done a running race before. And this must have been 2017. And so I thought, how fit I am, and did a half marathon. The rest, as they say, is history. I don't really know what happened, whether it was the result, the positive, that sounds too ego-driven to say this, but the positive reinforcement of, I'm quite good at this, maybe I should continue. That sounds a bit sad, but I think that probably was it. I was like, I'm all right, give this a go. And it is genuinely quite sad, actually, to look at my life now. It is entirely running focused. Like, my life is running, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it is quite funny to think that. 7 years ago, I guess, it was not even on my radar. And now, look at me now, or look at all of us, I guess. But yeah, that's it.
I was going to say, so you finished university, you've come out with a BSc honours in sport and exercise science. Why not go straight into that as a career instead of you decide to almost jump ship and go for the Royal Marines?
Good shout. That's, quite this gets into a broad topic shift. I was quite, in a nutshell, happy with me being super honest and blunt, I was quite lost when I finished university, I needed to choose a path of structure and discipline and kind of, I don't know how full on you want to go, but I definitely needed to change my immediate situation to something with a bit more safety. I was looking for kind of a brotherhood and a family connection and the rest of it, which the military absolutely gave me. It served a purpose, and it was what I needed at the time, for sure. At the time, I didn't, even when I first signed up to my sports science degree, I didn't ever see myself, which is why I smile now. I've never really ever seen myself working in, like a coach or exercise physiology. It was just what I was interested in. I didn't picture myself in that job, which sounds a bit silly, but the advice I got at the time was just study what you're interested in, do that. So I did. So I suppose when you look at me now and think, well, you did this degree, why on earth didn't you just go straight into it? I often think that, but it was a definite, it was a worthwhile diversion, if you want to call it that, to the path I'm on now. Because also, like, when you think about obviously the practical theory of exercise science, I probably learned very little in the Royal Marines, but in terms of the endurance mindset and all the rest of it, I have. It taught me a hell of a lot, which I still draw on now and hopefully use to help others. So definitely it had, there's crossover for sure. But yeah, I needed to sort some personal shit out, if you put it that way, before I entered career world. So I chose the Royal Marines as my therapy.
It's really interesting, actually. Your background is very similar to a client I used to coach who is also based in the UK in Northamptonshire, and he was in the Royal Marines and he went and did long distance ultra endurance events for himself, and now he organizes and takes groups of hikers up to some of the highest peaks in the world on expeditions, which is kind of very similar to your path as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I wonder if I know him. Go on, I feel so no longer unique, Rob. Thanks for that. Just ten a penny. Another Royal Marine. No, it's a common thing. What was his name?
Jack Fleckley. Yeah?
No, I don't know. I'll check him out. Maybe we can combine forces.
I'll send you his profile after the show.
Yeah, please do.
So you finished the Marines, you end up working for Ultra X in 2019 as directing races. And then it all, COVID occurs, the racing finishes, shuts down. There's not really much to do, I guess. But Ultra X started hosting their own local races and not international races once they're allowed. I remember that. But then talk us through what happened in 2020, because I think this is almost like a pivotal moment in where then perhaps tailor-made coaching and events perhaps came from, or the path that maybe you're on now.
Yeah. Is it you, are you digging at personal things? Is that what you mean? Not digging, that sounds like the wrong word, but.
No.
What you're talking, it sounded like you were using an event as an anchor there, just so I'm on the right same page as you. Are you
no, I was just saying, like, yeah, like it's, I mean, I'm just looking through, I've got a timeline of events, if you like. So I was hoping at the end of 2020, there was, I guess there was a suicide attempt.
Yeah, sure. I was just checking. I'm not sure. I'm still not really sure what the vibe of the podcast is. Right? I didn't know whether I wanted to go full in.
We have no limits.
Go anywhere. No limits. Okay, we have two listeners. Sure. They won't mind.
Okay. Well, tune in, guys. To address the I guess the Ultrex COVID stuff. Well, yeah, like you said, it was. Ultrex is very much an international events business, as you know. That's kind of how we came across each other, and COVID struck that off. But we had a good time, kind of adapting very quickly to hosting domestic events, and they've still got a great portfolio of domestic races, which I imagine they might not have had COVID not happened. So, you know, always try and look for some silver lining, I suppose. But for me personally, it was a year of I don't know how much of it was COVID related, but just the significant kind of change and the stuff now that I feel like I can openly share. When I was talking about the reasons I went into the Marines, again, I wasn't sure what the vibe of the podcast was, but I was struggling with drug addiction and stuff at the time, and that's been a kind of a pattern throughout my it's how I coped with my depression and mental health issues. Essentially, it was what I used to survive, which some people might find a hard concept or just a difficult thing to appreciate, but that it was a survival mechanism more than anything else. I think drug addiction particularly has a stigma for being something that one does for, I don't know, a choice or personal gain, and I'm sure definitely there is recreational drug use, which is done for fun, and people do that. I'm not saying that's not the case, but certainly for a lot of people I know who've ended up with addiction issues, it's not a lot. I don't know if you know people who've struggled with this sort of stuff, but it's not that ain't fun to be in it, and certainly it doesn't take you long to look at someone who's in that zone to realize that that's not someone wouldn't choose to put themselves there. So it was how I survived, and that was why, as I mentioned, going to the Marines, and that very much being what I needed at the time. lo and behold, it didn't quite last as long as perhaps would have hoped. And then 2020 happened, and some personal life circumstances, end of a relationship, and it being the obvious stuff, which COVID did have an impact on all of us, I'm sure. Maybe I'm downplaying it by saying, well, I don't think it has anything to do with COVID. It probably was a bit. And I ended up surviving again, which is the word I use for, to put it bluntly, using drugs to deal with my reality. A good way, I suppose, if you want to talk about the addiction topic, what someone once said to me, that another addict said, drugs aren't my problem, drugs are my solution. And that was, for me, was a really powerful moment of, I'm totally the same. Reality was my problem, and drugs were how I solved it in the short term and got through. But obviously, it's an unsustainable road to head down. And I, for whatever reason, at the end of 2020, felt like I couldn't go on. I did try and commit suicide with a drug overdose. I failed, and 2021 began, a new year of dealing with recovery and rehab and all the rest of it. I don't know where your timeline is, Rob, or where we want to kind of go next.
I think it's interesting. We don't necessarily have a lot of, I guess, the people that we deal with here in the UAE, they don't have a lot of access to, the cocaine, heroin. But what they do have a lot is, or what we see a lot of substance abuse, I think, is with alcohol. And there'll be a lot of people. I certainly read lots of Facebook forums in the groups I'm in, where there's lots of single men, married men, men that maybe just have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, whatever, and their way of coping with things is to go and sit in the pub. That seems to be their only outlet. And quite often they say similar things. It's not, they feel that that is a solution and they can't get out of it. It's almost like a repetitive cycle then.
I remember to bring some science into it, I suppose, if that's useful. I don't know how useful it is, but well, I've started now, so I may as well. The study that gets talked about a lot in addiction circles, and it's somewhat been kind of criticized since, but there was, if you had a Rat Park kind of this thing, it was a study conducted by, I think it was a Portuguese health minister, I think. I could be wrong about that. Maybe he heard the study and that was why the Portuguese system treats drugs not as a criminal offence or whatever, I can't remember. But the study was that they had these rats and they were in this park, I guess if you want to call it that, and they were, the water was had a choice between like regular water that I think the drug was cocaine, had cocaine in it. And the rats in this situation, there's nothing else in there. They kept going back to the cocaine water bottle. And that the whole point is that there was nothing, they were alone in this setting in a cage with nothing to interact with. I don't know what their food situation was like. Anyway, the comparison was Rat Park, which had, there were different rats of, opposite sexes that they could mate with, which rat want to do, and they had, I guess, good food and all these other bits they could play with. And really interestingly, with no other intervention, the choice between the water and the cocaine water was equal. It was random. They didn't seem to be going towards choosing addiction or chemical addiction to chemical, which is interesting. But when you really look at it, it's very hard to generalize any of these studies because they're rats to humans. But that's kind of when you talk about these guys who you might see down the pub, like their reality is possibly this first version of this kind of caged rat with a lifestyle that maybe isn't what they wanted, what they perceived for themselves, and it's quite hard daily struggle to get through. And the thinking, which is quite clear, it's worth saying, I suppose, in the study, is that if you can create external circumstances that are similar to Rat Park for a human, with love and support and and all the other things, whatever it might be that person needs, the need for a solution to get through is eradicated. So yeah, I guess, maybe that's useful. I don't know, in some ways to understand it, it certainly helped me when I first heard of it. But yeah, it's an unfortunate reality. And it's not always men, of course, but it is something that I do see among men more often than not. Maybe that's just my bias and who I communicate with.
Was it something you noticed when you went into the Marines? That was kind of your rat park, for want of a better term. Did you notice the difference in yourself?
Yeah, in terms of the, so obviously your, what you're missing is very individual. So some people, the rat park dream will be very different. But for me, it was connection and being in a setting like in the Marines. A lot of people, and I found it difficult times for sure, but you are never alone. Like you live with, you know, you start off sleeping in a room with 60 other men, a massive room, and you get a bit more privacy towards the end, but you're always with six other blokes in a room, you know, training, you're always sharing a bivvy with someone else, and it's constant, you know, you were just never, yeah, you have this connection, which previously, that was what I was missing. And it's an interesting point to bring up, because there's another resource, a really good journalist called Johan Hari. He's written several books, both about addiction, but also about depression, and his, I think the most recent is called Lost Connection.
It's a good book, actually, worth reading.
You've read it?
Yeah, I did, last year or year before.
Yeah, I think it's basically, so for anyone who's not, that the premise is that the opposite to depression isn't happiness as much, it's connection, and it's his whole energy.
Yeah.
You can, I think there's about 12 steps or something. I don't know. Maybe, Tom, you want to share a bit about that?
Yeah, I can't remember it. Like you say, what his steps were, but it was all about stop trying to fix it through more drugs and almost numbing yourself, and actually start trying to fix it through creating connection and reaching out to people. And like, straight up, mate, massively admire you to come on here and say, you know, what you've been through, because that's almost what, sometimes hiding it can actually lead you back down that road of being on your own, like closing yourself off, and then, like you say, the rats who are on their own go back to the cocaine water, because it's the stimulant, isn't it? And yeah, he's saying, let's get people off these drugs, don't work to fix depression and anxiety. I mean, they might mask the problem, but like you said, your drug addiction wasn't the solution, it was the survival mechanism. And this is sort of where we're getting to with medication towards, you know, the mental illnesses, and actually turn your phone off for 2 days and go and talk to people, go to Rat Park, wherever that is for you. That's basically the premise, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad you read it. That's good. Yeah, it's I found it a really useful book. And so yeah, so for me, in terms of your question about the Marines, that was the connection for me. I don't know whether, you know, because obviously you then say, well, I came out of that situation, and you know, not that long after, I'm back in. I don't necessarily. There's obviously always changing circumstances, and it was several years after I left the Marines before I felt the need to use drugs again, and ended up in a state where I felt like I needed to take my life. But still, yeah, I definitely lost some element of connection, clearly.
Were you worried to leave the Marines?
Yeah, definitely.
Why did you?
I actually left primarily because I was in a relationship, and it's difficult to, you know, I perceived myself to be getting everything that I thought I needed originally when I joined the Marines, because I didn't have from this new relationship. And of course, you can be in the military and have a great relationship, and you know, rob the child of, you know, military relationship and all the rest of it, and it can be done. It's very challenging, and I felt like I couldn't. And ultimately, I was totally stable in terms of the thing, you know, compared to who I was before. I guess it's again, I really don't think it was me losing the connection to others that I had in the Marines that led me down that path. But there is an element, you know, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. When you're stable, it's not like, right, thanks very much, I'll move on now, I'm fine. If you take that away, but you never know until you take that risk. Sometimes it's
And was that the relationship that ended in 20? It was, yeah.
Yeah, which is when you look really at it like that. Mate.
That's yeah.
Quite, it was, yeah. Thanks, Tom. Yeah, it's quite. It shows you that when it's telling, actually, I haven't really thought about that in terms of that connection, the connection kind of passing on. You've got the Marines fulfilling my Rat Park needs and then the relationship. And then that went, and yeah, it wasn't long after. That yeah. ended up kind of at rock bottom. So yeah, I guess there's a connection thread throughout it. Yeah.
You're creating your own Rat Park, which is actually the cool part of this. It's like you've yeah. seen the power of it. And I mean, we should stop saying Rat Park. It's not a great term, but
yeah, yeah. It's like, why are all my clients but getting called rats?
yeah, Rat Park coaching sounds better than tailor-made coaching.
Actually, does have quite a good ring to it, Rat Park coaching.
you've taken something like really powerful to you, and you're using it to drive your life now, which you must feel like you've got a pretty strong sense of purpose when you wake up every day.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, for sure. It's coaching is, and it'd be interesting to hear your take on this, but like it's a tricky one because someone said to me recently, actually, what we were talking about, what you like about it and what you don't like. But I think, Rob, your coaching is very much, or Tom, do you do coaching as well? I singled Rob out there, but I don't actually know. You do, you both coach, yeah. Like you do a lot more like face-to-face, like hands-on stuff. Mine primarily, I'd say a good 80% of it, there's some face-to-face elements, is online. I was saying the other day, like actually something if I was going to say something that I miss about, you know, previous work, or like when you do coaching like this, it's like, I don't have any colleagues, like I work for myself alone, like it can be quite lonely. But the flip side of that is that I have X number of athletes that I'm working with on, you know, I communicate with certainly at least once a week with all of them, some of them, you know, every single day, literally the same, you know, every individual I speak to, you know, and that's quite amazing, like to have that sort of constant communication. And that's something that I think really helps me, and being having an element of like responsibility in some ways to those people, and not that I feel
it's accountability as well for you, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah like we talk a lot about the accountability in like from not top down makes it sound like a hierarchy, but from coach to athlete, but like is a huge amount in reverse from athlete to coach. And that's something that, yeah, when you talk about getting up in the morning with purpose, I don't feel that. And it's a positive thing because you can go down too far maybe and feel the pressure of that. I don't, touch wood, ever feel that. It's just a positive desire to be a role model and to help others if I can. And that is a good feedback loop, again, of connection and accountability. So I enjoy it from that perspective. You want to talk about coaching? What do you enjoy? Is that a good way to go down? Does that ring true for you guys? Does that land?
Yeah, I guess. Well, Donzy, maybe hear your take. Obviously, I know a lot about your coaching, mate, but you've come at it from a different point of view as a teacher. Mm-hmm. What do you?
Yes. So I guess I always loved the element I enjoy was always seeing something click. So, you know, if you're teaching high-end algebra to a bunch of 17-year-olds that don't get it, and then you reframe something a different way and you just see the light bulbs go off. And then you almost get the same when you take a runner and they reach, they might have a sticking point, or there might just be one session where something all goes to plan, they hit the runners high, maybe they hit their paces for the first time, and it all just clicks, and it's exactly the same feeling. And I still get excited when I have a coaching call or somebody tells me about their goals or what they want to achieve next, I think I get more excited than they do sometimes. So I think it's, yeah, it definitely means you're in the right job.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I completely empathize with that. And then I suppose maybe a nice segue into the other work I do, maybe that if we're happy to go there, but like that. So for me, I absolutely get that. And then what's nice about the event stuff when it's not always, you know, the kind of world record stuff. Sometimes just adventures, then that belittles it unnecessarily. It's not, you know, sometimes it's about charity fundraising events, and sometimes it's purely just someone wanting to have a cool adventure, and that's as worthwhile as, you know, the FKTs and the world records. But what is sometimes amazing when you do world record type stuff, especially as a coach who's coached someone through it and then an organizer, like you're, like you were saying there about seeing the light bulb moment or helping someone hit their pace or their runner's heart. Basically, that's just an extremely concentrated, like you're to be a part of someone's peak moment, because some people, this would be certainly the top five biggest moment in their life, possibly even the number one up until that point. And to be a really embedded in that, and not just embedded, but to help that person on that way, is a feeling unlike any other. I really hope I don't feel like I take it for granted. Not now. I hope I never ever do, because it's to be able to do that once in a lifetime is amazing. To do it once a year is incredible. To do it 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a year is just amazing. And it gives me so much, when Tommy, you're saying about that drive and passion in the morning. Like that's a high that lasts for weeks, months, far longer than any drug, that's for sure. And it's a real privilege. And I guess that's what you're saying, the privilege of teaching and coaching. It's all part and parcel of the same thing.
This is actually one of the reasons I wanted to get you on, because I was following people, as you do on Instagram, and you're following these guys. That I was following Leon Busty, who is a friend of one of my family members. They're based in Norwich, or used to be based in Norwich. And then I was following Josh, what's his surname now? Peterson.
Yeah.
When he ran his 72 consecutive marathons in 72 cities. And every time I was like, every so often, your face would pop up. I just come into that, thought, oh, there he is again, he's running with them. And then I did a bit of digging. It's like, oh, actually, you arranged and did all the logistics, all the organization, all the background work to be able to make these challenges possible. And then I started following Imogen as well, who I know you're currently working with. She was the youngest person to run from John O'Groats to Land's End, or the other way. And she is doing something spectacular now, where I think she's going to do the three peaks and cycle in between.
Run
in between. Hell. How much of these challenges, there's obviously an element of coaching involved. There's the, you can talk about the aerobic fitness, we can talk about the mental aspect of it. How much for you is drawn from experience from the races that you've done? Because we kind of skimmed over this. Since the end of 2020, we know there was the failed suicide attempt in 2021, where most people would be looking at recovery rehab. You signed up to the Tour de Gijon, and you raced that in 2021, in September.
I think Dragon's Back was 2021.
Sorry, Dragon's Back. The 380K through Wales. Mm. And then the following year, you did Tour de Gijon, which is a single stage 330K with basically 25,000 meters of elevation. And then this year, just gone, you did the Winter Spine, or went for the Winter Spine, which is the whole of the Pennine Way, isn't it, from Edail in the Peak District all the way up to the Scottish borders. So how much of the events that you do draw from those experiences you've had versus thinking in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many bits to that, isn't there? Like there's an element of like, where to start? Well, it's just my mind is like, which one first? I'll go with like the what do I suppose a part of my role is being like just a lot of it is just being someone who can who when you're in the depths of hell despair as the runner, you can look at for, you know, it's almost like the captain of a ship in a really bad storm, and a good captain hopefully will, you know, stay calm. He's been there before. You know, because the element of some of these events, like you, or all of these events, have an element of, there is definitely a line. This is not just physical, push your body to absolute breaking limit at all costs, and if you die, so what, we tried, right? No. You can 100% cross a line, and it's a really vague one. And that, I would say, is the most useful part of prior experience, because, and my experience will only be, can only ever be my experience. Like I can suggest when I've been in a similar thing, this might, you know, be the what you're experiencing now and whatever. So it has to come primarily from personal experience, but to be the individual who can suggest that we stay the course, like Leon Buston is a good example. There were, and that's probably the only one so far where I've got to the point, or the challenge has got to the point where, and let's just quickly introduce it, if anyone doesn't know, Leon ran John O'Groats to Land's End in just under 14 days, like 13 days and 20 odd hours, something like that. Which is it about 80 to maybe 90-ish kilometers a day. Just like seriously hardcore multi-day running. We were at times when his injury situation kind of got really bad, were doing 20 hours of a day without running, walking, doing the challenge, and then you've got some travel to get to the accommodation, so sleeping for 2 to 3 hours, but there's a middle peak of about 4 or 5 days like that, which is a hardcore routine, not just for the runner, but obviously for the crew, and we're a small crew. And that was the first time I've got to the point where I started to question, wait a minute, have we crossed the line here? Is this safe? And Leon, for context, one of the other crew members was his friend Josh. And it's one of those things, I'd be interested to get your take on this. I always say to people, I think it's a classic line of like, never do these challenges with the people you love the most, because it's too confronting to have, for you to have them there and have to kind of manage what, you know, their emotions when they're seeing you, and also vice versa for them to see you in, especially if they don't get it, if that makes sense, if they're not runners. The flip side is, unfortunately, these events demand so much that typically it's only family members or very close friends that can come and help support. Anyway, the point I'm making in a roundabout way is that when we were on this challenge, to have Josh, who's a really close friend of Leon, and probably has, not that I don't care for Leon, he's a really good friend, but I didn't have the background of a relationship that they had. And yeah, it was, there were a few days where Josh was rightly seriously concerned, and it was of whether we, you know, we were putting his long-term welfare or giving that enough respect and consideration in cracking on. And so that's, to answer your question, I suppose when you, it's having some experience of, and it's always the best guess, right? You never know for sure, but you, part of the big responsibility of being the kind of leader, if you like, in these situations, is sometimes having to, even though you're doing a best guess, you can't share that. You've got to, you know, you have to be rock steady. Say, no, this is, I've been here before. This is, we're still on the right side of the line. You know, can't put numbers to it that, you know, you're 99% broken or whatever, but you can gauge it roughly in some sort of way like that, and say, look, I, having been there myself before, having witnessed others before, and knowing you, as hopefully by that stage as well as I do through the coaching process and whatever, we're well under control. And sometimes I'm not as confident as I might seem at those times. But yeah, I guess that's probably what I would say the most valuable experience of having done it yourself is, is getting to that point and reading signs. And you have to have a really good relationship with the other person, because also, like, I know my signs and you'll know your signs when you get to that place. But someone else might, they might not express themselves in the same way. They might, you know, have an extremely unemotional response to pain. Like some people have, even though they can tolerate it, have extremely high pain tolerances, but be quite emotional in the way they share it. And it's knowing that, okay, fine, this person is, you know, being quite emotional, and but I still think that for them, they're under control. They just, part of the process of sharing it. And other people, Leon's one of them, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying it, it's a compliment, he's very good at not engaging with that. He's kind of a witness to his pain and all that experience. But then it's really hard for you to gauge and be like, he's just not giving me anything. I don't know where he's at. You know, yeah. So I think that's an answer of some sort. I don't know.
I was going to say, at some stage, your responsibility, I guess, has to stop, and there's going to be a stage one day maybe where you do have to pull the pin on someone's challenge. So ultimately, who makes that decision? Is that your decision? Is that the athlete decision?
Good call. Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not something I would do. It always does come down to the athlete. I mean, a good way, I've shared this before, I don't know if you guys have come across this tactic, but I will do it myself in my own races, and something I encourage athletes to do is have a set list of rules beforehand for reasons that you would pull the plug. And that's, well, it doesn't really matter what they are, but the point is, in a non-emotional, rested state of mind, you can write down these, if any of these, sometimes it's just 2, 3, 4, whatever it is, but if any of these situations occur, I will happily pull the plug, and that I'm okay with it, and I'll live forevermore with no regrets. And obviously for the idea being that if one of those situations occurs, I could present this kind of contract, if you like, and say, we've hit number 2 on this list. I don't care how emotional and tired you are right now. We're at number 2. We agreed beforehand. It's in your hands now. But just so you know, this was what the rested, normal you decided. And that can be a good way. I've unfortunately never had to pull that contract out. But that's something that I think anyone should do. It's harder if you don't have a crew, because when you hit those times yourself, you're so in it that you more often than not just go, no, I'm not there yet, just blast on anyway. But if you have a crew, I think that's a good use, certainly something I found quite useful. But no, ultimately it's down to the athlete. As long as there's not a danger to anyone else or me, you have to, one way I look at it is sometimes I've kind of, maybe this is me viewing it into spiritual terms, but a way I've kind of thought of it before is almost like a kind of like a shaman, if you like. And I cringe when I say that, I know that sounds ridiculous, but on someone's journey, and you kind of guide them to the point at which, you know, they're whatever it is they need to experience. And normally it's that point which everything is telling you to stop, and you have to make the decision to continue, right? That's the definition in my mind of real endurance. And you get them to that door, and then actually, I'm out. I shut the fuck up. I let them step aside, and then they're on their own, because that's not for me. It's not my business, and whatever happens in that scenario happens. I don't control that. So there's also, like, an element of, this isn't completely controlled. I'm not. There's only so much you can do, and there's only so much you should do, because it's not about me. It's about them. And when it comes to, obviously, the primary goal might be to break the world record for trying to go to Land's End, for example, something like that. But the process of going through that is kind of the point for the athlete. And so I don't want to stop them before they get to the point that they might need to get, even if that means they don't finish the challenge, right? Because sometimes you might push yourself a bit beyond, then that costs you the challenge, but you learn something much more valuable. And again, it's not for me to decide. So it's a difficult one, having to learn to let go. It's interesting to hear your take on it, because that's what I find about the coaching, the hardest bit is then having getting the athlete to the point of, like, right, you're on your own now, and you've got to, like, yeah, trust them.
I remember just a little anecdote from the weekend just gone, where we had some athletes that were trying to do 24 hours in a place called Cat Springs, which is a little mountain range we have just about an hour and a half away from here in Dubai. And I always go back to, we had a guy on the podcast that did a marathon in every county in England. And he said something that always stuck with me, and it was never make a decision sitting down. I thought that's actually really, really clever. Really, because he used to run out and back loops from his van that he'd drive every day to run these marathons and then drive home. And it's just like those days where he sat down and was like, fuck it, I'm done. I don't want to do any more. I'm stopping it. And then he'd stand up, start walking, and then continue, obviously. And it was when the guys would come in from these 12.5K loops, they'd sit down and be like, that's it, I'm finished. And I'd be like, okay, fine. Stand up, go get some food. And then I'd sort of walk over to them and go, you could do one more. Just one more, just start walking and do one more loop. And 8 times out of 10, they would go and do one more loop. But the guys that stayed sitting down and said, that's it, I'm done, then that's they were done. Really interesting.
Yeah, it's a good one, that. I like that. Don't quit before you sat down. Yeah.
Mate, I've got a question. Maybe we'll finish up here, but you're around a lot of people who are aiming for performance, whatever you see performance as being, but they're trying to perform an amazing feat of endurance. Maybe in a performance context or maybe in a general life context, you've seen a lot of people succeed and maybe some fail or maybe a lot fail, depending on which event you're working on. But what do you see as being the people who succeed? What do they have that you see the people who fail don't?
Oh, I wish you'd asked me that before and given me some prep signs. That's a hell of a question. mainly because one of, not because I feel the pressure of coming up with it, because it's a powerful one to get right, I think. Because I think it's the sort of question that people might genuinely try and emulate whatever answer I give to try and be these people. I mean, not always, and this is a tricky one to, well, I was going to say, it's a conversation I've been having a lot that quite often, and this is definitely not always, this is not always the case, but people will have, we'll call it a story, right? And you probably see where I'm going with this already, but and it doesn't have to be, you know, a story of trauma, because, you know, that wonderful athletes out there who are very fortunate and never had anything like that, but they still have a why. And it's, I'm always disappointed in myself for saying this, because it's such an obvious answer, but like having a really, really strong why is something that across the board, everyone so far that I've experienced doing something incredible has had. And it's that, again, the crux of it is being able to get to the point, as I said earlier, where you, everything in your fiber of your being is telling you to stop and you choose to continue. And that's really, really, really fucking hard, like unbelievably hard, but it's also very simple, and it's as simple as that. And if you don't have the foundation of a why and a really internal why that you connect with, it can't be an external thing, which is why the record sometimes, there's too much focus on, you know, whatever the record is. It's you hunting a record is often not enough, like a time or whatever, because when it really, you know, shit hits the fan, you might think you really want that record when you're sat at home 6 months before planning it, but when it comes to it, like quite often it's just getting this record isn't enough when you need to continue in the harshest of storms. But having a super strong why, and also this is not in any way me plugging myself, but having a really good team for these, certainly when we're talking about these big adventures type stuff, even though, you know, the ones I haven't organized, but, you know, the ones that, you know, all the other record breaking ones that are one consistent theme, if you're looking to do some sort of FKT or big attempt, they've all had really phenomenal crews. I can't really name any who've done, there are some great solo attempts, but, you know, normally it's obviously a solo record you're breaking, gonna do well without a really good team around you. It doesn't have to be me, of course. I'm not talking about business, but yeah, having people that again, it's that connection thing. If you connect and lean on others in those moments, it's a very, a very distilled version of what we were talking about earlier in the addiction and survival type situation, when you're in that survival mode of, oh my god, everything's telling me to quit, I want to continue, having connection to draw upon, someone you trust to be that captain of the ship, I suppose, is really important.
Yeah. External motivation gets you to the start line, but internal gets you to the finish line.
I've heard that before. Very good. Love that a lot. Yeah. It's so true. Very, very true.
Yeah. Excellent. That was really good, mate. And very, well, you just come from an extremely unique place, which I'm sure you wouldn't wish on others in a few cases, but like you say, you're doing a lot of positive work with it, and you definitely can't, your why is obviously massive, and you're creating a team around you, which is very, very smart. Trying to go it alone is not always the best way. So yeah, mate, huge admiration to you and what you're doing, actually.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I feel I met myself earlier. Rob, I feel privileged. Go on.
Yeah, we'll let Rob book more guests in the future.
is this an unusual Rob, not the cast director? No,
like he's that. Had a few that they just don't show up.
That's not fair.
Love it.
What was it like three times in a row? I think we got stood up once.
We did, yeah, three times. That's the record.
He's wow. got a so restraining order on him against Jess Ennis.
When I was 4 minutes late, then you must have really been panicking.
Yeah, we were like, should we do an intro? We're like, well, what will we intro? What if he turns? What if he doesn't turn up? We can't intro him and then he doesn't turn up. We've done that before as well.
Yeah. That's quite a badass move, isn't it? To get your intro on a podcast and then that's it, no show.
Amazing. Taylor, thank you very much for your time and being so open and honest. I think it's very clear that what you've done is you've taken things that have happened in your life, and you're now, you've overcome all that, and you're giving back in a way that not many people could really, I think, see without doing something or a big challenge themselves. You don't really know the impact that someone like you would have in that process. Anyone that's had a really good coach or a really good teacher, or a really good, I don't know, a really good influencer in their life, I think will understand. But if someone's not quite had that, I urge someone to try and find someone like that in their life, and then they can do good things together.
Well, if I'm that person, then my DMs are open, but maybe I'm not, who knows. But yeah,
I can how can people get in touch with you if they want to reach out?
There's a website, TaylorMade Coaching and Events is what the business is called. The website is taylormadecoaching.uk. There's a bunch of information on there, just if you're interested. And Instagram is the best way, isn't it? Taylor Chris Taylor, as you said at the beginning. Call me Taylor if you reach out. Don't call me Chris.
And Taylor amazing. With a Y. Not just a good Y, but also a Y in the name.
Yeah, that's full a great
marketing
thing.
Genius, mate.
You're giving him why. Stop giving him to giving him everything for free, Tom.
That's phenomenal. Come on. We've got that on record. How that he said it first though. Cut the end of it.
Amazing. Thank you very much.
Thanks guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
See you soon. Bye.